All right. More questions from the fine listenership on X. Part 5. Why do you do philosophy, Steph? Well, it's funny because I would say that I don't so much do philosophy as philosophy does me. And what I mean by that is the ideas, the inspirations, the arguments, the clarifications come fast and furious. And I just kind of channel them. Of course, I put work into refining and all of that kind of stuff, but there's something that songwriters talk about. Roger Hodgson talks about this with the Logical Song, where he says, like, who knows where that comes from? And Bob Dylan says, you know, like, if I could write those kinds of songs every day, that's what I would do, right? I mean, how long has it been since Paul McCartney had a hit, right? Well, he would write yesterday every day if he could, right? But do you write the songs, or do you just kind of prepare yourself with rigor and then go through the process of creation? But I won't say the songs write you, because that's kind of cliched, but you don't kind of do songwriting. Songwriting kind of does you. So I don't do philosophy. Philosophy kind of does me. A lot of the stuff comes out of the unconscious and out of a certain kind of semi-feverish inspiration. The analogies pop into my head and I shape them and move them, but it is not something that I do. It is something that is almost done unto me. This is what people who create say, that they're just kind of channeling something deeper or wider than themselves. And that certainly is the case for me. And I, you know, try to be rigorous and make sure that it's not just some seismic unconscious blarp that echoes out across the world, confusing people, but to try and shape it into something positive. But I would not say that I do philosophy. I would say that philosophy does me. Now, of course, I have the choice as to whether I express it or not. But philosophy is the most essential aspect of being human. It is what we do that the animals don't. And it is what everyone does. Everyone is philosophical. Everyone justifies what they do. Everybody appeals to abstractions. Everybody universalizes it. You can see this with little kids from very early on. I know this from my own daughter, from working at a daycare for many years. Kids abstract, kids generalize, kids universalize. And so philosophy is the most essential aspect of what we do, and philosophy is the only thing that can save us from evil. Now, evil will use philosophy against you. If you do not use philosophy against evil, you will lose. Evil is armed, right? And if you're not armed, you will lose. So you either use philosophy to protect yourselves from evil, or evil will use philosophy to destroy you. All right. Are we unwitting slaves trapped in a prison planet? And if so, how do we escape this situation? I think what you're talking about there is childhood. If your parents are violent or dysfunctional or brutal or molesty or whatever horrible things might have been going on, then you are, of course, an unwitting slave as a child and trapped in a prison planet because you can't get out of your parents' household. And I hate to say it, but I can virtually guarantee that no one and nothing is coming to save you. So if you have this feeling of being an unwitting slave trapped in a prison planet, well, then you're probably thinking of your own childhood. And of course, you have infinitely more choices available to you as an adult than you ever did as a child. So to escape the situation of being trapped in dysfunctional relationships, my recipe has been the same for well over 20 years, which is you are honest about your thoughts and feelings, about the relationship, the complaints that you have, the issues that they have, and particularly with your parents, the fact that you had no power or independence or choice as a child. So you're honest about that. And what you do is you work to try and improve the relationship. If you can improve the relationship, fantastic. If your parents improve the relationship, if they admit fault and maybe get some therapy or work to improve, fantastic. It does happen. It's rare, but it does happen. And if you're parents continue to be dismissive, gaslighting, abusive, mentally torturous, you can choose to stay in the relationship or not, but you don't have to stay. All right, have you ever done an episode on epistemology? I would love a deep dive into that. Pyrrhonian skepticism versus academic skepticism. Descartes' basic problems of knowledge about the world, foundationalism, coherentism, infinitism, etc., but in a layman-friendly format. That's a fine question. I have done a whole Introduction to Philosophy series. It's a 19-part series that you can find at fdrurl.com. No, you know what? FDR Podcasts. Sorry, fdrpodcast.com. Just do a search for introduction. You can get that I have done a history of philosophy. It's up to 23 entries. I've yet to take on Kant because he's so enormous. I'll need some time to prepare for that. But epistemology, the study of the standards of valid knowledge. How do we know something is true and something is false? Very, very briefly, of course, reason and evidence determine truth from falsehood. Logical consistency means that something might be true, combined with empirical evidence means that it is true. And if you think of sort of the famous argument, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Well, that's reason, it's consistent, and it's also based on evidence, which is that everyone dies. So, all right, 18. What was the plan once they built the Tower of Babel and got so high? Yes. Well, the Tower of Babel is kind of an analogy for the development of reason, science, and philosophy. So what I mean by that, of course, is that human beings, as they gain heights in conceptual knowledge and ability, begin to approach the contradictory nature of the definition of God, consciousness without material form, which doesn't exist. Something which is older than the universe, which is kind of a contradiction. Something which creates the universe, which itself was not created, is sort of a contradiction. Being all-knowing and all-powerful is a contradiction. If you're all-knowing, you know the future, which means you're powerless to change it. So you can't be both all-powerful and all-knowing. So as human beings start to ascend the heights of reason and science and knowledge, they begin to doubt the existence of God. And so as people begin to develop knowledge of moral philosophy, they begin to doubt the validity of brute political power. And of course, as this knowledge began to spread and grow, what did God do? Well, he smashed it up and he scattered people, he gave them different languages, he split them up and so on. And of course, as people begin to have skepticism about the moral validity of brute political power, well, what happens? Well, governments split people up, divide people, introduce people with different languages so that there's less cohesion and so on. So it's the same thing. All right. Is the race for AGI the race for world supremacy? The first one that gets it must destroy the other so that they maintain power? I don't think so. Supremacy is based upon political power, not on AI. So those who are the most willing to use political power, particularly against their enemies, tend to win. So let's see. If a government is to be of, for, and by the people, what incentives should it be providing, as it seems historically that they only can incentivize their own personal interests? Yeah, so most people, when they think of the government, they're really only thinking of their parents. That's all. There's nothing more or nothing less or nothing deeper or in a way nothing more shallow than that basic fact. When people are talking about the government, they are talking about their own parents. When leftists are talking about the government, they're thinking about their own mothers. When people on the right are talking about the government, they're thinking about their own fathers. They don't really pierce through the veil of parental authority to discover the true nature of political power. So if you look at people's views of the government, that the government should, what should the government do? Well, you know, it should give you money when you're poor. It should give you money when you're broke. Well, that's what parents do. The government should pay for your health care. Well, that's what parents do, right? Governments should educate you. Well, that's what parents should do, right? Governments should make sure everything is fair between citizens. Well, that's what parents do, particularly mothers, between siblings, make sure everything is kind of fair, right? The government should intervene to help the less fortunate. Well, that's parents intervening to make sure that the weakest and youngest child gets an equal share of food, right? So people aren't talking about governments at all. They're simply talking about parents, which is why when you talk about a stateless society, people freak out because then they're thinking, how are things going to get done? In the same way that if parents say to a five-year-old, we're no longer going to supply you with food and shelter and healthcare and education, the five-year-old will be, but how can these things be provided, right? They don't, because they're five, right? So most people, when it comes to the state, and this is why people get so peculiarly intense about politics, they're not talking about the government, they're talking about their parents. And particularly if you have bad or neglectful parents, then a lot of people want the government to make up for all of that. But Of course, when you want the government to be like your parents, it means that you stay yourself in a state of perpetual childhood, forever reaching and manipulating. And people, of course, say, well, I'm going to bring pressure to bear. Kids, they're going to nag their parents, whine to their parents, they're going to try and control and manipulate from a helpless standpoint. Their parents are going to beg their parents to do things, and the parents are going to make promises that the parents break, but then the kids are going to get upset. And right, I mean, that's voting, right? We want the government to do this, and the government promises to do this, then this doesn't happen, and people get mad, and they start it all over again. I mean, honestly, people are just functioning in a very primitive state of childhood with regards to the state, and they are simply viewing the government as a parent, right? And government finances are mysterious and opaque to most people. And of course, kids just want their parents to pay for things. They don't understand the finances of their parents and so on, right? So, and of course, if you were to say to a kid, you say to a five-year-old, well, daddy might have to borrow the 10 bucks to buy you candy. What's the kid going to say? Yeah, great. I get my candy. I don't care about the, I don't really understand. I don't really care about the borrowing. I just want the candy, right? Or, you know, if the kid wants a rocking horse and the parent says, well, we're going to have to put on a payment plan and, you know, we might have to be able to buy less later on, maybe. Kids just like, give me the rocking horse. I don't care about that other stuff, right? And that's the same thing, of course, when it comes to government spending, and they don't really understand. They just want the free stuff. They just want the cool stuff and so on, right? So if a government is to be of, for, and by the people, what does that mean? Well, governments are supposed to serve the people through their power and authority, the government's power and authority. And of course, parents are supposed to serve their children through their power and authority. Oh, governments are supposed to do what's best for the people, even if the people don't like it. And parents are supposed to do what's best for their children, even if their children don't like it. And for most people, of course, governments are authorized to use force, although they don't really think of it that way. They just think of it as discipline and consequences and punishment and FAFO and things like that. And in the same way, parents are supposed to use coercion, violence, spanking, confinement to rooms. It's like prison and the naughty corner or sitting on the naughty step or something like that. Supposed to use the force gently and blah, blah, blah. So in the same way, governments can only keep order through using force. Parents can only keep order and instill discipline through using force. Honestly, people, like 99.9% of people, never break out of thinking of the government in terms of the family. And it doesn't work, of course, right? All right. If everything we see, feel, smell, and touch is just the same type of atoms arranged differently, and each atom is 98% empty space, then are we experiencing a simulated hologram? That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, if the atoms are objective, atoms aren't simulated. But I would strongly, strongly, strongly urge and caution you to stay the ever-living fuck away from these kinds of ideas. Like this sort of End of Men in Black stuff, right, where the whole universe is like a marble in some alien. Like, don't stay the fuck away from these kinds of ideas. They are literally demonic. They will mess up with your sense of reality. They will screw with your sense of ambition. Everything turns into a waking dream. You will be dissociated. You will be defensive. Life will pass you by and you'll get increasingly aggressive. And whatever you invest into, you defend. And whatever you defend, you spread. So if some turbo sophist bullshit artist has convinced you in this ridiculous simulation hypothesis, then you're going to invest in it, and you're going to make decisions based upon it, and you're going to be dreamy and distracted and dissociated. You're going to waste your life because there's no difference between playing a video game and being in a simulation. So you will invest in this, and you will not have moral courage. You will not do the right thing. You will not passionately pursue things because it's all a simulation, and you're above it all. And you're going to spend years or decades of your life thrashing around in this useless swamp of narcissism masquerading as simulation theory. And then when people try to disprove it from you, you're going to fight it tooth and nail, because if you spend years wasting your life to some degree because of this simulation theory nonsense, then if it turns out that you were wrong, you have fucked up enormously, like catastrophically. And not only have you fucked up enormously, but you probably spread these ideas to others, and this mental infection of dissociation called simulation theory has has infected others and you can't go fix their lives, you will have become a pretty bad guy. Stay away from this stuff. If you want to disprove, essentialphilosophy.com. Essentialphilosophy.com. All right. With AI replacing most jobs in the near future, what should we as humans focus on? Assuming most jobs will disappear and not everyone will have a job. I don't know. I don't know, honestly. I mean, certainly thinking is the best thing that you could do as a human because AI can't think. So thinking is a very good thing to do. Thinking is a great thing to do. And so I would certainly train yourself on how to think as a whole, how to be original, how to be creative. And you don't need a huge degree of intelligence to think clearly. In fact, there are very smart people who can twist themselves into all kinds of Gordian knots of convoluted lower intestine bullshit, whereas people who work with their hands, people who work with actual matter and reality have a great deal of common sense. So, you know, I don't particularly care. I don't particularly care. People will figure it out. I mean, as I've said before, we went from like in America, there was like 90% of people were involved in farming. Now it's like 2 or 3%. People will figure it out. They will get the right thing done and they will find some way to sort it out. And, you know, if people don't, I don't really care. I mean, I'm not going to virtue signal and say I am bound up in the fate of all mankind. You know, I mean, I don't really care because, I mean, people didn't care about my childhood. People as society as a whole didn't care about, you know, when I had a job that was this gold panning and prospecting job that I did, and then the tax incentives changed. You no longer got tax credits for this kind of exploration, so that job dried up. And then in the early 90s, I graduated. There was a terrible recession. I couldn't even get a job as a waiter. Like, nobody cared. I just puzzled it and figured it out. And, you know, of course, as a white male, right, there are lots of legal barriers against hiring white males, and society doesn't particularly care about that as a whole. In fact, it seems to kind of celebrate it. So I just don't care. I'm not going to care about people more than they care about me. And I'm not going to preen my imaginary moral feathers and say that I care about everyone and everyone's equal. It's like, my caring is reciprocal, right? If you care about me, then I will care about you. If you don't care about me, I don't care about you. And so people will just have to figure this shit out in the same way that I grew up without any particular moral instruction, you know, with terrible schools. And, you know, I just had to kind of figure it out. I had to push my way forward, figure it out. And nobody cared about how I made my way forward. And nobody cared that it became very hard to hire people like me. And I don't care. You know, the society will progress. I'm certainly doing my best to help people learn how to think and train people how to think. All the stuff that was denied me as a kid, I am, you know, working hard to do good things in the world. But I'm certainly not going to twist myself into Gordian knots because some people might lose their jobs. I mean, seriously, you'd have to be kidding me about that kind of stuff. I mean, society didn't care when I lost jobs or careers or opportunities and so on. Society didn't care that I was badly educated. Society didn't care that I was abused as a child. Society didn't care as a whole that I was deplatformed. In fact, a lot of society kind of cheered that on. And I just found a way to adapt and I found a way to move forward and I found a way to figure it out. And people do what they don't. But I don't care. I mean, honestly, I'm just being honest with you. Maybe this is shocking. I don't care that it's shocking. I don't care. Society is pretty selfish. Society doesn't care about me. Society doesn't care about you, and so on. And so if people are having a tough time because of AI and jobs are uncertain and jobs are changing and so on, it's like, eh. You know, when I was a student or when I was younger, I spent some time working in offices as a temp. And then, of course, a lot of those jobs got replaced by, you know, like I would be maybe, I wouldn't say exactly a secretary, but I would be like somebody who'd organize trips and do meetings and set them all up and so on. And then that stuff all got replaced by software tools for booking trips, booking meetings, making sure everyone was there and sorted and getting it right. And so like nobody cared. Nobody was like, oh my gosh, but the poor people who are doing all of these trips and organizing all these meetings and running all of this stuff and so on, like what's going to happen? Nobody cared. It's like, oh, sorry, your job's kind of not necessary now. We've got computers to do it. So you have to figure something else. Oh, like nobody cared. And I'm not even complaining that nobody cared. I'm just saying it's a basic fact that nobody cared. You know, I'm a pretty good thinker and communicator, and nobody took my course up in university and said, boy, you know, we got to make this kid a professor. He's really talented. I mean, my talent was recognized. I was considered to be one of the two brightest students in all of the universities that I went to. And I had essays read out to the class. They were considered, I mean, professor said, this is the most perfect essay I've ever received. And he read it out to the entire class as an example of a perfect essay. And yeah, nobody's like, oh, well, we gotta make sure to get this kid's talents harnessed in a professorial something, something. Like, nobody cared. You have to find your own way. To find your own way, and nobody cares. Now, I would like it if society did care more as a whole, and hopefully we could build a kind of society like that going forward. But yeah, people don't care. You know, like if the old age pensions run out, I don't care. Any more than the boomers care that I and the generations that came after me are born into massive debts that they voted for. Like if the money's out, then they're going to have to figure it out. I don't care. Because the boomers aren't sitting there saying, oh my gosh, well, we've got all these deficits and these debts. We can't possibly hand those debts and unfunded liabilities, millions of dollars, to the newly born. I mean, they're certainly not responsible for it. They didn't vote for it. They didn't even have a vote. They weren't even alive. Right? So they didn't care about me being born into millions of dollars of debt and unfunded liabilities. They're fine with it. They had their entire lives to save. They had their entire lives to vote better. And they didn't. And they preen and crow and are overjoyed and all of this kind of stuff and rail and attack and, you know, get mad and lie about people who try to fix this moral situation. So if the money will run out, right? The money will run out. I don't care. So, oh, but it's so bad. It's so hard. It's like, yeah, well, you know, you reap you sow. Like I'm no longer interested, and I haven't been for quite some time, by the by, I'm no longer interested in protecting people from their own corruption and immorality. And it is wrong to vote for a bunch of free stuff and then pass the bill on to the next generation. It's absolutely fundamentally wrong. It's evil. Evil. And I don't know. If evildoers run out of money, are we going to mourn? Oh no, it's so sad. So yeah, I don't care. And I would suggest and invite you to not care as much either. All right. Is polygamy immoral, especially in an age of single moms with deadbeat baby daddies? Voluntary, of course. The arguments are always against forced polygamy. So I would say that polygamy is not a violation of UPB because it is voluntary. There's a gray area. And the gray area is, let's say that you smoke. Is smoking immoral? No, because it's a harmful habit, but it harms yourself primarily. However, if you are a chain smoker who's decided to have 5 children and you have no life insurance, then first of all, your smoke could harm your children. And secondly, you can't be as good a parent if you're smoking because you have to keep having smoke breaks and you can't parent your children and you drop your ashes into the baby as you change in the diaper or something like that. And of course, you're risking your health and you are inflicting ill health upon your children at a much earlier age than they should have to deal with it because maybe you get sick in your 50s rather than in your 80s. And so it's a real gray area where you are doing things that are not technically a violation of UPB directly, but you are causing a great deal of suffering among the innocent. Now, it's not the case. Your wife chooses to marry you. You're a smoker, and then she's obviously taking the choice. But your kids don't choose. So if you're doing things that are extremely likely to harm your children, that's not a direct violation of the UPB. I would put it in aesthetically negative actions, that it should be discouraged, but you can't use force against someone. Like you can't shoot a smoker for smoking around his kids, right? So I would put it strongly in aesthetically negative. So polygamy, if you don't have any kids, I think it's gross. I think you should be responsible for your own healthcare costs, right? Because polygamy is very likely to lead to, you know, STDs and maybe unwanted pregnancies and all other kinds of stuff. So if you want to do polygamy, you can do polygamy. If you involve kids, though, I would consider that. I would not spend any time socially with a polygamist. I would not hire a polygamist if I had sort of true freedom of association. because I would just view that as pretty gross and bad. So I would say that it's aesthetically negative, but not an evil violation of UPB. And also, I mean, when children are involved, it's very bad. Children are designed, of course, to pair bond with two parents. And of course, the more polygamy you engage in, the more likely you are to end up in a situation where you fall in love with someone else or fall in lust to someone else and so on, right? Or maybe, you know, if you're a polygamist, then you go have sex with people, you bring home herpes, and then herpes is transferred to your children. Well, that's pretty bad, right? So yeah, it's pretty bad. All right. Can there be a consciousness aware only of itself? No, because consciousness develops through interaction with the outside world. So no. What if the true nature of reason itself happens to be conscious? Don't know what that means. At what point is a person obligated to intervene for the greater good? And at what point does that transition to self-defense? I don't know what that means. I don't know what you mean by obligation. I don't know what you mean by intervention. I have a vague sense of what you mean by the greater good, but I'm not sure indirectly. So if you want to rephrase that. And generally, if you're going to ask me an abstract question, give me an example or two. All right. I answered the homeschooling question today on the live stream. Not a philosophical question necessarily, but of your literary work. Your novel called The Present was truly incredible, and I would recommend everyone to read it, especially young women. Do you believe the dire and chaotic events towards the ending depict an accurate future scenario? Yes, I do. I do. I definitely do. Is coffee a drug? Why or why not? No, coffee's a stimulant. A drug is generally that which alters your perceptions in some fundamental way, right? So LSD is a drug because it gives you visions, and weed is a drug because it alters your perceptions in fundamental ways, and so on, right? So mind-altering drugs. Coffee is not, doesn't mess with your perceptions. It doesn't mess with your, doesn't give you hallucinations. It doesn't, you know, zonk you out or anything like that. So, I mean, it's a stimulant, and it certainly alters your body and brain chemistry to a small degree, but no, it's not a drug. Otherwise, vitamin C is a drug, right? All right, where do the rights of ownership come from, and is there limitations to ownership, especially with land and natural resources? So we own ourselves, and we own the effects of our actions, right? If Bob strangles a hobo, Bob owns his own body, therefore Bob, quote, owns the strangulation, which is why we put Bob in jail, and not his hands or Sally or something like that. So we own ourselves, and we own the effects of our actions. Is there limitations to ownership? I'm not sure what that means. Because how would you enforce limitations to ownership? So generally, the way it's worked in common law is, and I know this from doing property work up north, I would stake out claims to land and then go look for gold. And the way you do it is you go in a kilometer, you hike in a kilometer around, and you hammer your little plates into trees, and then you get a certain amount of mineral rights for a certain amount of time. And generally, you have to invest some kind of labor. Like, you have to fence something in, you have to clear the land, right? You can't just point at the map and say, I own this 10,000 acres, because then everyone can do that, right? And it all cancels each other out. So generally, you have to invest some kind of labor to make unowned property your own. And so if you go and build a cabin in the woods, and the woods is unowned, then the area around your cabin is owned. You own your cabin because cabin only exists because you've made it, and you only make it because you expect to keep it. So property rights is not the protection of property. Property rights is the creation of property. Right? Nobody writes a beautiful poem on the surface of a lake, right? Because it vanishes, right? So property does not define that which is. It is responsible for creating what is. So for instance, if you're hungry and you want to go fishing to get some fish for dinner, if you knew ahead of time that your fish was going to be stolen on the way home, would you go and fish? No, there would be no point. You'd go find some other way to deal with your hunger. So you wouldn't fish. So the fish only exists as property, right? The fish in the lake is not property. It can't be used by anyone. So you go catch the fish, you bring it to the surface, you club it on the gunwale and whatever, right? You fry it up. So the fish has been transferred from unowned to property, to utility, because of property rights. So you don't have the fish as property. You have the fish because there is property, because there are property rights. No one would bother planting crops if they knew for sure that someone was going to burn them down or steal them all or poison them, or like, they wouldn't bother, right? So property is created because of the expectation of property rights. So yeah, we own the effect. I mean, if you would never bother building a log cabin in the woods if you knew that you were just going to get kicked off it and it was going to get disassembled, right? 5 minutes after building it, right? So property rights creates property because you own the effects. You own your body. You own the effects of your body. And so a property is not for that which exists. Property creates something that exists. So if you, you know, you square off an acre of land, like you go and hammer it in, you start clearing it all out. You're doing all of that because you expect to keep the property, right? So you clear the land, you build your log cabin, and you plant your vegetable patch. You do all of that because you expect to be able to keep your property. You wouldn't do any of that if you did not, if you knew ahead of time that you weren't going to be able to keep your property, you wouldn't bother doing any of that, which is why people don't generally build log cabins in public parks, because they're just going to get kicked off, right? So a property is not for that which is. A property is for that which only is because of property rights, only comes into existence because of property rights. And as far as limitations to ownership, what does that mean? Does that mean somebody, I mean, property is what can be enforced. I mean, there's a moral right to it as well. But, you know, the old possession is 9/10 of the law. So property is that which can be enforced. And so when it came to unowned land, you would need some investment of labor in order to mark the property as yours. You can't just wish it. Otherwise, everyone could wish it. There'd be no such thing as property. So you'd need some investment of labor. And then you would also need some time frame in which to develop the property. So the way that it worked when I was gold panning and prospecting is you hammer your plates or your plaques into trees in a kilometer square. And then for 5 years or whatever time period it was, for a certain number of years, you get the right to develop a mine if you find something really good there in terms of gold. If you don't do anything with the property within 5 years, it reverts to unowned. And of course, when we were out there, occasionally we would come across like really rusty old plates from like 40 years ago or whatever. People did something and didn't find anything. And so it reverts to unowned. Limitations on ownership, it's what you can enforce. If you're going to say, well, we want to make sure that a company that makes tents doesn't corner the whole market and control the whole market, well, the only way you can do that is to have some uber government, which is based upon the violation of property rights, so that doesn't work either. So, all right, under the empirical epistemology, the origin of supernatural ideas like perfection and infinity is impossible unless they would be experienced at some point. All the arguments contrary redefine the concepts or make a leap of reason that would require direct experience. I would say that I answered that in Friday's show, and that is the 31st or 29th, 29th of August, 2025. You can look at that for the answer to that, as is why is homeschooling looked so down upon in Europe. I did that. All right, I will stop here, as I already did a show today, and I've got a big social calendar of fullness this afternoon. And actually, I had a dream about doing a speech. I had a dream about doing a speech again. I really miss that sort of public stuff. But maybe we'll sort that out at some point. All right. That's a really foundational question. Somebody says, I haven't been able to square not wanting to be forced to contribute to Social Security while knowing some others would definitely not save by themselves. I don't want to live in a world where people are eventually out on the streets when they are at their most vulnerable. It's a fine, fine question. And I appreciate the sensitivity of this. And I mean, I share it to a fairly significant degree. But this is one of the grave, real challenges of compassion, is compassion in the now versus compassion in the future or overall. So I'll tell you, it's like a funny little thing that happened. When I was a kid, I used to take the radio and put it in my room. Now, I wasn't really allowed to listen to the radio, but it was a little portable radio, had some batteries, and I would take it, and I didn't, you know, sleep a huge amount as a kid. And what I would do is I would listen to radio shows, radio plays, or whatever, just sort of help me fall asleep and so on. And I still listen to audiobooks often when I'm falling asleep. Thank you, Audible Timer. But in one of the shows, I don't remember much of the shows, but one of them, someone's house burnt down and they were like, oh, but at least we have insurance. And I did understand the concept of insurance back then. I was maybe 9 or 10. And I've always loved reading economics. So I hate to sound horribly precocious, but it is what it was. It was what it is. And so at least we have insurance. And then it turns out that the insurance company said that they didn't have insurance. And then one of the characters found in his coat the letter saying, I want insurance, which also had the check to pay for the insurance, because this, of course, was back in the day, long before the internet. And he's like, oh, I was on my way to mail it when the check, when the house burned down, or I was on my way to mail it, I got distracted. So basically, the house burned down and the couple in the radio play got nothing because they hadn't mailed the check to get insurance. And, you know, that is a very, very tough situation. So everyone who pays insurance, whose house doesn't burn down, you know, let's say you pay $1,000 a year for your insurance. So, you know, 50 years, $50,000, you know, plus, right? All the money you could have got if you'd invested that money instead, right? So you invest that, you probably have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars instead, right? So everyone who has the home insurance, who doesn't need it, and very few people do, very few people's houses actually burn down, well, they kind of feel ripped off, right? Right? They kind of feel gypped, right? Because they paid all this money and they didn't use it, right? And so they feel ripped off. They feel upset. They feel, you know, I mean, you don't really think about it because you kind of know, right? You kind of know. And you know, like whenever you mail a package, ooh, do you want insurance on this? Or do you want insurance on your luggage or whatever, right? There's lots of different things that you can do, right? Do you want to, like when you book a flight, do you want to pay extra so that you can cancel, right? Cancellation insurance, right? And of course, everyone who pays extra who doesn't need to cancel is annoyed, right? Clearly, because they paid the extra 25 or 50 or whatever it is, bucks, and they didn't need to cancel, right? So this balancing act is always the case, right? Every time you buy something, you know, online, especially electronics, right? There's always a, do you want an extended warranty? Do you want an extended warranty with that? You know, it's 4 years for only $150 or whatever it is, right? Now, people who take that warranty and don't have any problem with their electronics are out $150, right? I remember once a cell phone company, I paid $10 a month in case my cell phone broke or got damaged or whatever it is. And then my cell phone did break and get damaged. I didn't drop it. It just stopped booting up. And I tried to invoke the warranty and it was like, well, it's $125 for processing. And it's just like, okay, so this is, you know, a little bit of a ripoff, or it kind of feels that way. So people who have all kinds of insurance are spending money and, you know, what are you buying? Peace of mind or whatever it is, right? So the people who spend money on insurance who don't need it or don't use it, they're kind of ripped off, right? I mean, I wouldn't say they're ripped off. They feel like, well, of course, if you knew ahead of time that, oh my God, someone driving like no high beams, it's like being interrogated by a Volvo Gestapo. But you feel like, well, what was the point of that? And yeah, okay, we all know it. But nonetheless, I still kind of feel like, right, you know, you pay all this insurance on your car for accidents and, you know, you don't get into accidents and then you're like, well, geez, I just paid thousands of dollars a year for 40 years and I didn't even use it, right? So, you know, that's all mandated and so on, right? But people don't generally rail and rage against that, right? But if you don't have house insurance and your house burns down, that's a really sad and tragic thing, right? I mean, your house is smoking ashes and I go, where are we going to live? You know, got no money and, right? Especially if your house wasn't even paid off, right? And it's tough. It's tough. For me, it's like, well, I hope you invested the money you saved by not paying for house insurance. I hope you invested that money or at least saved it so you've got a place to live until you can figure things out, right? That's the big challenge, right? I mean, if you didn't pay your $1,000 a month, sorry, your $1,000 a year, let's say, on fire insurance for your house, if you didn't pay that and your house burns down and you didn't save that money, right? You just blew it or whatever it is, right? Spent it on wine, women, and song. Well, then you're out of a house. And what do you do? Well, you're out of a house. And, you know, society is kind of brutal this way on kids. And that's where I get a lot of my reference from, which is if you're going to inflict it on kids, I expect you to inflict it on adults. So there were times, I don't know if this ever happened to you, probably did, maybe it did, but there were times in my childhood when I legitimately forgot there was going to be a test. Like, I forgot. I didn't consciously decide not to study for it, right? I forgot, literally forgot there was, and I had to take the test, and if I did badly, I did badly. And if I did enough of those badly, I lost a year of my life because they'd hold me back a year, right? So that's what they inflict on kids. Legitimate. And of course, I understand that every kid could say, oh, I forgot there was going to be a test. And, you know, there's no way to tell. So I understand why they couldn't accept that as an excuse, because every kid would say that, right? I forgot robbery was illegal, right? So I get that. But to me, it's a gamble. So if someone takes their life savings and puts it on Red 22 and they lose their money, do I owe them money? Right? There was a guy I interviewed many years ago, wrote this fantastic book on the 07-08 financial crash. And one of the things he said was, he ran a bank and ran a bunch of banks, I think. So there was someone, a customer on the phone, who was demanding that his mortgage be reduced because the value of his house had gone down. And this guy picked up the phone and said, so you want us to charge you less because the value of your house has gone down, right? And he said, well, yes, it's only fair. And he said, well, let's say the value of your house had gone up and you sold it for a big profit. Would you give us any of that money? Long pause, because of course, you know, anybody who's honest knows that if you double your money, whatever, you sell your house for twice what you paid for it, you're not going to sit there and say, oh, Mr. Bank, you were the one who financed this house. I'm going to give you a portion of the proceeds. Like, you just keep that money for yourself. So he said, so if there's a downside, you want us to pay, but if there's an upside, you want to keep all the money. Well, if you're going to keep all the money when there's an upside, you got to take all the loss when there's a downside. That's the way it works. And it's kind of unassailable, right? I mean, you can't really argue with that. Now, it could be the case, of course, if someone saves $1,000 a year by not having fire insurance, it could be the case that they throw this amazing block party with all that money, right? They invest the money. Let's say they double the money somehow. They spend $2,000 on this amazing block party, which you go to, and maybe that's where you met your wife, or, you know, what, you had just had such a great time that you remembered it for four generations or something. Okay, well, at least they've done something for the community. And then maybe the community might be interested in helping them out with their loss if their house burns down, right? But let's say that somebody is a drinker and a gambler, and he takes $1,000 a year that he would have spent on house insurance, and he spends it on drinking and gambling, or clothing, or, you know, excessive clothing, or gym membership, or whatever. But it's for him. It's not for anyone else in the community. So if you don't invest into the community, then how can you expect the community to invest in you? If you're some Boo Radley shut-in, right? I talked about this in my book, Art of the Argument, artoftheargument.com, right? The woman who does all kinds of wonderful things for the community. She brings lasagnas to the sick and takes care of people's kids and, you know, helps out with everything that she can think of, but doesn't actually have much saved up for if she gets sick or whatever, doesn't have insurance. Then if she gets sick, people will probably chip in because she's invested time in the community, not money in her savings. In the same way that if you are a stay-at-home mom, you raise your kids, they love you to death, you homeschooled them, you did all the right stuff, you were kind, gentle, wonderful, nice, and loving, and let's say your husband dies, there's no life insurance for whatever reason, right? Well, you have invested in your kids rather than in a job, and so your kids will take care of you when you get old, right? That's the general way that this stuff works, right? You invest and people invest back. So when people lose their house, they don't have insurance, right? The house burns down, they don't have insurance. Almost always, they lie. I didn't know. I didn't understand. I thought I was covered. My husband was supposed to take care. Like, they're just lying. And how do we know? In the same way, if I say, look, I totally forgot about this test, man. I'm a teacher. I'm really sorry. They don't know. So they just have to treat me like I did know, right? So people will lie. Because if people say, look, I really didn't think my house was going to burn down. I really appreciated, you know, the extra $2.50 a day. So, whoops, you know, I kept $1,000 a year and I didn't use it to pay for insurance. And unfortunately, my house burned down. That sucks, right? But no, they have to play the victim. But insurance is gambling. Nothing more, nothing less. You are gambling. If you don't pay insurance, you're gambling that nothing goes wrong. That's it. You're just gambling. If you don't have insurance that covers a slip and fall on your front porch and somebody's delivering a package and they slip and fall, then you saved X amount of dollars per year without slip and fall legal insurance. Somebody slips and falls, and now you got to pay. And do they say, well, I guess I gambled and I lost? Because that's what it is. It's just gambling. If somebody takes their life savings and their retirement savings and puts it on Red 22 and loses it all, do they really get to go to the community and cry that they are victims? Well, no. Now, if someone doesn't save for their retirement, I have no problem with that. Because if, let's say, two parents pour everything they have into their kids, right? Making their kids happy, paying for sports, education, hobbies, whatever it is, right? And they don't have any money saved. But the kids are incredibly grateful for the wonderful and easy start that the parents have given them. Then the kids will help out because the parents invested in their children, not in their savings. And the kids will doubtless happily take care of their parents when their parents get old, right? Because that's where they invested. And that's fine. I'm not going to tell people, of course, what they should or should not invest in. If you want to invest in your relationships rather than having insurance, that's fine. If you take the money, let's say there's a woman, she takes the money from the household that would have been spent on life insurance for her husband and instead invests in her kids or invests in Bitcoin or something like that. And then her husband dies and she doesn't get any life insurance. Well, she invested in her kids. She invested in Bitcoin or whatever it was, right? It's like this, it's like renting versus buying. I don't know. Do what you want, right? So if people don't save for their retirement, the question is, for me, are they honest? The issue for me with, say, single moms is not fundamentally that they're single moms. It's that they lie about it. My issue with marijuana users is not foundationally that they're marijuana users. It's that they lie about it. It's the lying about it that I can't stand, not the fact that you are a weed addict or not the fact that you're a single mom. It's the lying about it because the lying about it recreates the problem. Let me sort of tell you what I mean. And then I'll tell you how it applies to insurance. So lying about it with regards to being a single mom is, have you ever met a single mom who said, I did not examine my childhood. I did not read any books. I did not go to therapy, even though it was free in high school and free in college. I did not do the work that was necessary. I found a guy sexy who had clear red flags. I fell prey to lust. I was a complete corrupt idiot. And now I'm really behind the eight ball, right? I've never in my life, in my wildest dreams, anywhere online, anywhere in my call-in shows, anywhere in my life, I have never met a single mom or a weed addict. And, you know, the weed addicts tend to be more male than female. So I'm spreading the love equally here, right? It's the lying about it. It's the lying about it. The weed addict doesn't say, you know, I'm managing my anxiety. Like if I stop doing weed, I get crippling anxiety, like panic attacks. So I'm just managing my anxiety. And I chose to do weed rather than deal with my bad childhood because weed was easier. Or something like that. Like whatever would be the most honest, what's the most honest thing you can say? Now, if you're honest about things, you prevent recurrence. So let's take single moms, right? So a single mom who says, He was the perfect guy. He said everything right. He did everything right. There was no red flags. There was nothing I could do to possibly tell anything that went wrong. And now look what happened, right? Well, by lying, they're making other women paranoid. And, you know, don't underestimate the degree to which the rise of single motherhood and lying about men is lowering the birth rate, saying that a man can be perfect, have no red flags whatsoever, and then a year or two in, if you have a baby, he just turns into a complete raging a-hole who's a sociopath, right? That has a huge impact on the birth rate because it makes women paranoid about men. Whereas if, and you've heard me, of course, ask this question a million times on my show, what were the red flags? What were the red flags? What were the red flags? And there are always red flags. Always, 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 always. And like I just did a call today with a guy who ended up in a horrible battle over his kids' custody, blah, blah, blah. And he had a child with a woman who was an untreated victim of absolutely terrible and appalling sexual abuse. All sexual abuse is terrible, but there are still different degrees of hell. And she was at pretty much the lowest level of hell. And she was untreated. And there were red flags. So the weed guy who doesn't say, I'm managing childhood trauma, I'm taking the easy route, and I'm an addict, and I'm helpless, is basically saying, don't do this, kids, right? Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do what I do. Do the opposite. Don't get trapped like I did, right? But if they say, well, it's all natural, it's not addictive, it's great, it opens your mind, it gives you insight, deeper consciousness, nature of the universe, blah, 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 and he's selling the drug. In the same way that the single mom who won't take responsibility for having a kid with a guy who's a terrible father is not taking responsibility. So rather than take ownership, she makes other women paranoid. Oh my God, a guy can be totally perfect. And then, oh, you never know, mask off. There was no way to know. So by playing the victim, she does not teach others how to make better decisions. She has them instead make worse decisions, which is, oh my God, I can't be with a guy because I've heard from all these single mothers that guys can just turn on you with no warning. They could be perfect for years and then turn on you the moment, right? It's just lies, lies. So she, the single mom, by lying about why she became a single mom or how she became a single mom, is just making other women paranoid and has to make terrible decisions, which is do not trust men and blah, 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 right? And then they become hedonists and just go after the pretty boys. And then if they get knocked up, the whole cycle repeats. So they're just, right? It's the same thing with the weak guy. So that's my issue. Now, if people getting close to retirement are like, oh my God, I have made the most terrible set of decisions. I've been thoughtless, inattentive, greedy, lazy. I have not saved enough for my retirement. I didn't even have kids. I got no savings. My parents are gone. I blew through my inheritance. I don't have any life insurance. I don't have any health insurance. I've just made the worst conceivable decisions. And here's how I made them. And here's how to avoid them, kids. And don't do this and don't do that. And like, okay. So I would have much more sympathy and I would actually be very willing to help people who did that because they're educating based upon their mistakes. And that's a huge mistake, but at least they're honest about it. That to me is the price of charity, is stop fucking lying. That's the price of charity. You're a single mom, you want help, stop lying. Stop insulting all men by saying all men are two-faced rat-humping bastards who turn on you the moment you get pregnant and there's no way to know ahead of time. That's just a lie and an insult to men and to women. So to me, the price of charity is don't lie to me. Don't lie to me. Because I'm happy to help out people who've made bad decisions in the past. I'm happy to help out people who've made mistakes, even if they've been continual and conscious. I'm happy to help, but you cannot lie to me. The moment you lie to me, I have no sympathy. The moment, because you're choosing to continue the bad decisions. You've learned nothing. You know, when I talk about my 20s, I don't say, well, I was the victim of all these people who were kind of false and only pretended to blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, I wasn't living my values. I wasn't living my values. And that's why things went to shit, right? I don't blame others. I blame myself. I hold myself accountable. Have you ever heard me whine about being deplatformed? Nope. I mean, it was unjust, sure, but I did it. I know the lay of the land. I'm not an idiot. Oh, I can't believe that the things I were talking about would be provocative to a leftist set of programmed NPC audio. Right? I know. Well, I'll leave IQ behind. So, yeah, not complicated. So, as far as insurance goes, hey, if people blow their money on stupid stuff rather than having insurance, that's fine. Be honest about it. Don't lie. Don't compound irresponsibility with money with falsehood, because then you're trying to get something for nothing, and you're still just as greedy as when you weren't paying for your insurance. Oh, I didn't know. There's no way I could have predicted. Houses haven't burnt down here in forever. I was confused. My husband was supposed to do it. He never did. That bastard, Leah. Like, now you're just continuing to try and get something for free, and you've learned nothing. And to me, if somebody wants my help, tell me the truth. Because if you lie to me and I give you money, I'm funding irresponsibility and immorality. I don't want to do that. I will fund honest mistakes, even multi-decade mistakes. I will fund that. I will not fund people who lie and play the victim when they did it to themselves. I will not fund that. Because if you don't care enough to tell the truth, right? If you don't care enough to tell the truth, then you clearly don't care about the money, right? If you say, well, Steph, I need you, can you send me $1,000 to rebuild my house? I'm like, well, why does your house need to rebuild? Where's your insurance? Oh, I sent it in, but they screwed it up, or I didn't even know, or like whatever it is, right? Like if you're just lying, right? Well, if you're lying, then clearly you don't care about the $1,000 that much, right? You don't. You do not care about the money that much. Because if you cared about the money, you'd be willing to tell the truth to get the money. But if you still continue lying, then you prefer lying to my money. And I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm not going to argue with you, but I'm not going to give you the money. Tell the truth. And my heart is open to you. Lie. And if you choose lies, then clearly you don't want the money that much. Right? Because I'll say, are you telling me the truth? Because if you say that the insurance company that you sent the paperwork in, if you say that, you sent the paperwork in, but they're just not paying. If you say that, and I find out that's not true, that's really bad, right? Because now you're compounding irresponsibility with fraud, because it's fraud to say something isn't your fault when it damn well is your fault. You chose not to get life insurance. You chose not to get health insurance. You chose to drive without being insured in your car. You chose to not get fire insurance or homeowners insurance. You chose all of that. Now, if you're going to lie and say that you're a victim and then try to compound lying with fraud, then I don't care about helping you. I will not help you. I will not help you. I had someone many years ago, actually not that long ago, he asked me for help. And look, I'm not going to go into the details, but yeah, I've helped people, right? And he asked me for help. And he said, you know, he was intellectual, like, we have to stick together, right? And we got to support each other. And I'm like, oh, okay. So if that's your philosophy, hey, man, I'm happy to help, but you know, please show me how you supported me when I was deplatformed, because you believe that we need to support each other, right? So show me, because if this is your belief, then you got to show me. Because I don't play me, right? Don't lie. Oh, we got to support each other. If that's your belief, then you would certainly have supported me when I was deplatformed, which was a pretty big event in the intellectual world, right? So, and of course, he couldn't show me anything, right? So that's that to me. So if you want my help, ask me for my help. And listen, if you say to me, listen, I need your help and I feel really bad because, and this is a terrible time to say it, I need your help. And not only do I need your help, but I didn't even help support you. I don't mean financially, but even just a blog post or a tweet about how terrible it was or whatever it is, right? You know, I need your help and I didn't even help you when you were deplatformed. I'm really sorry about that. And it's a terrible time to ask your help. I'm really ashamed about that. I'll work to make it up to you. I did the wrong thing because I did not support you, but now I'm asking you to support me. Okay, fine. I'm sold. You know, I'll help. But don't lie. Don't lie. Don't lie. Don't lie to me when you're asking for my help. If people fess up to their mistakes, they're doing a good social service, right? So a woman who became a single mom because she had the hearts for an obviously dysfunctional guy, and she then talks to young women about the dangers of lust, she's doing a good social service. And in my view, I'm not saying she deserves, you know, like coerced help, but I would help someone like that because they're providing a good social service by telling the truth. Maybe they make some videos talking about the mistakes they made and how to avoid them, fantastic. I will help. I will help. Because you're actually helping others. But if you lie, then you're deceiving others. I will not help. Because you don't even care enough about my money to tell me the truth. And therefore, it's just a kind of fraud. So if somebody is a gambling addict and they lose their money and then they say, oh no, I was drugged, man. And I didn't know what I was doing, right? And let's say I found out that they weren't drugged, right? I'm not helping them. In fact, I will avoid them because they're now compounding crushing levels of irresponsibility with outright fraud and deception. And I will not participate in that kind of crime. It is, to me, is a moral crime to pretend to be the victim when it's your fault. To pretend that you are being victimized when you made the bad choices is a form of spiritual fraud I will not give one thin Satoshi for. But mistakes, fine. Hey, man, we all do it. We all make mistakes. And if you've made a mistake and you're honest about it and you work to help instruct the world on how to avoid your mistake, that's as noble a thing as you can do with bad decisions. You know, I have ignored red flags in dating and I have talked about those. I have not lived my values and I've talked about that. And I have talked about my mistakes and my errors. I have a whole series of shows on I Was Wrong About, called I Was Wrong About. And when I'm in the wrong, I apologize, I take responsibility, I make restitution, and so on, right? So, and even then I'm not perfect, right? I could be a bit too snappy and impatient from time to time, for sure, for sure. But it's other people's fault. Haha, just kidding. So, when people make mistakes, they don't buy life insurance. That's fine. And if they say, look, I really gambled wrong. Please, kids, don't do it. Don't not buy life insurance. Don't not buy home insurance. Like, don't just get your insurance. I really, really made the wrong decision. Now I have to throw myself on the mercy of the community and I have no excuse. And right, that to me is noble. That is noble. Or that's as noble a thing as you can do with bad decisions. No problem with that. But I know. If you lie to me while asking for my help, that turns my heart to an absolute block of impossible ice. Now, I can tell you that, and then if you're like, you know what, you caught me, and that's even worse because now I was asking for your help and I was lying to you, and let me sort of figure out why that was. Okay, but if you just keep lying, nope, I will not fund it. I will not fund it. I will not. I won't do it. I won't do it. Because if you prefer your lies to my money, then I will let you have your lies and not my support and not my money, right? Because if your solution to irresponsibility is to lie and play the victim, then there's no point giving you money because you're just going to blow it again. Like I'm not actually helping you. In fact, I'm harming you because then I'm rewarding your lying. So, no, I will not. So, I hope that helps. Now, as far as, you know, well, people will die in the streets. Well, without government insurance, people will save. People will save. And there will be some people, there will be occasional people who don't save and who lie and who continue to irritate and annoy the community and who didn't invest in their kids and this, that, and the other. There will be those people for sure. And they will suffer. And I don't know if we should. I don't want to live in a world where people who are corrupt never have to suffer. People who lie, people who cheat, people who have the sort of spiritual theft of this kind of stuff. I do not want to live in that world. I think that's pretty terrible.